Dr. Watkins, thanks for joining us. I'd like to kind of start off with if you could share what you've seen so far with this outbreak and what you feel that people really need to understand should they feel like they may be experiencing any symptoms with COVID-19.
So I do about 50% emergency medicine shifts and then the other 50% medical toxicology, so working with the poison center. So I would say that in my experience in the emergency department, our patient volume is down right now. We're seeing fewer patients than we normally would for this time of month. However, in El Paso, the pandemic is supposed to peak in about 2 weeks from now. So we are putting precautions in place and really gearing up to see a huge surge in patient numbers. But at this point, I would say to people, you know, if you feel a fever and a cough or chills or other symptoms that are fairly mild in nature, then I would urge you to stay home. And you can certainly call your doctor and ask for the next best steps. But unless you're pretty ill, and please do come to the emergency room if you are feeling like you have a hard time breathing. But if you feel like you can manage your symptoms at home, that's going to be safer for you and safer for the community.
What do you think are the most important things that emergency rooms should be preparing for right now with the possible surge expected to happen in the area within the next couple of weeks?
So when patients are starting to come in with symptoms that could be due to COVID-19, I think it's really important to keep them in a separate area of the emergency department from the patients who are having other symptoms like a broken arm or something like that. We really want to separate patients to limit the amount of exposure. You know, we don't want to make people more sick.
With the surge expected to happen, how do you feel that that's really going to impact professionals who are working in emergency rooms and in hospitals and overall in the medical community?
Well, you know, you may have heard around the country that personal protective equipment is in short supply right now. So I think that's on everyone's minds right now in the medical community, is hoping that we'll have enough to keep ourselves safe so we can keep helping everyone else, keep helping our patients. At UMC, we are taking steps to preserve our personal protective equipment so that we will have enough available to us. Other things that we're considering here in El Paso would include, for example, the number of ICU beds that we have in the community and the number of ventilators that we have, and just trying to predict that we have adequate numbers to take care of patients.
How do you feel the coordination is going right now between state health officials and officials there in El Paso County and in the city?
I think in terms of a city-wide response, I think El Paso is being very proactive. I know that the Border RAC has had meetings with representatives from all of our hospitals in the city just to help coordinate our preparation and response efforts, which has been really great.
Now, it's obviously a unique area living on the border. How do you feel that makes the situation a little bit more unique compared to other places in the country that are facing COVID-19?
Well, what concerns me as a toxicologist, which means really helping patients who are exposed to different types of chemicals and poisons, what really concerns me is our proximity to the border and the availability in Mexico for anyone to obtain certain drugs like chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin that really have not been proven to be effective in treating COVID-19, but that are very dangerous in certain situations.
How can these drugs be dangerous in certain situations? We've already heard the reporting on a couple in Arizona. With the kind of misinformation out there on what may be able to help prevent COVID-19 or cure COVID-19. What are the facts really telling us right now?
Sure. Well, that couple in Arizona, unfortunately, they actually took some powdered fish tank cleaner that contained chloroquine phosphate, which is the active ingredient in chloroquine as an anti-malarial drug. In the U.S., we have more commonly we have hydroxychloroquine. Chloroquine is not really used too often in the United States because we don't have malaria. But hydroxychloroquine is available in the U.S. and Mexico, and it has very similar toxicity to chloroquine. And so either one of those medications can interact with certain medications that a person might be taking chronically for conditions such as diabetes or heart medications in particular. And then in an overdose situation, unfortunately, these medications can be very lethal, and it only takes a little bit more than the usual prescribed dose to cause poisoning with these medications, and people can die very quickly.
What can you tell us about what we've seen so far in what medical providers have been using to treat different types of coronaviruses?
Well, I suspect that a vaccine is still probably at least a year or two away. And so until that time, we really, it seems like multiple countries are really escalating their research into a possible treatment. But unfortunately, especially in terms of hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, there just isn't any data to show the effectiveness of these medications against COVID-19.
Testing has been so critical for countries that have managed to do a better job at flattening the curve than other countries. Why do you think it's such a major issue here in the United States to really coordinate an overall testing effort for COVID-19?
That's an interesting question, and I don't know that I have the answer to that. The United States is very large, and I know that one thing we hear a lot about is that testing supplies, there's just limited availability. And so most patients who come to me in the emergency department, they might have symptoms consistent with COVID-19, but if they're not sick enough to be admitted to the hospital, then we really aren't able to test them. So we're not doing testing in the emergency department. And there's limited testing available for our hospitalized, especially intensive care unit patients. But I think just like with the rest of the country, El Paso is limited in its ability to test.
In El Paso right now, if you go in for a test, how long do you think it will take to find a result out?
For the tests that have been sent to the health department for our critically ill patients, it's usually about a 24 to 48 hour turnaround time before getting the results of the test. But if you go to one of the outpatient testing centers, then I believe it's several days, like 3 to 5 days or so.
What are the things that you need to see before you recommend somebody get tested?
So most patients will have pretty mild symptoms, fever, cough, maybe some vomiting and diarrhea. It's the patients who we really worry about who may have underlying medical illnesses like diabetes, heart disease, and especially if a person has a low oxygen level in their blood or an abnormal chest x-ray or CAT scan. Those are the ones that we are really much more concerned about having serious illness and who we're more likely to be able to test for COVID-19.
So there's been a lot of talk about the need for contact tracing. Could you kind of explain how that works and if implemented, it could work in El Paso?
I think overall, the best thing about contact tracing is it really allows us to have a better awareness of how well we're using our personal protective equipment and how well we're washing our hands. And so contact tracing is where you find everyone who has had contact with a COVID-positive patient and then evaluate those folks to see if they have become ill with COVID-19. And so it can help us learn more about the disease, for example, how infectious the disease is, but it can also help to teach us how to more effectively use our personal protective equipment and take care of ourselves.
What are some of the things that you're finding out from people who have lost their lives due to conditions involving COVID-19? Is there any data that you can share with us of how it really attacks the body?
Sure. So most patients who have lost their lives to COVID-19 are older patients, usually over age 65, but the risk of death increases with increasing age. So the elderly or people with underlying medical problems who are already kind of sick on a day-to-day basis are going to be more at risk of death from COVID-19. And the way that it attacks the body is most severely through the lungs. And so we see chest x-ray and CAT scan findings of just really horrible pneumonia.
For people who recover from COVID-19, is there likely permanent damage to the lungs?
I'm not sure if we have data on that yet. And if we have, I'm not sure.
What parts of the body does COVID-19 really attack? You mentioned the lungs. Is there any other systems in the body that people are seeing a great deal of issues with when they get COVID-19?
Yeah. So mostly it is the lungs. But people also are having some gastrointestinal symptoms. So nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea are happening as well. And then one more unique symptom you might have heard is that some people are losing their sense of smell and taste. So it does seem to be affecting the nervous system as well.
Is there any concerns with medical professionals that this outbreak may impact the number of students who decide they want to pursue a career in medicine?
Well, I hope that it will inspire more students to want to help out and take care of others. I think that's sort of a central part of what makes a lot of students choose medicine is the desire to help others out. And so hopefully they won't be deterred too much by the pandemic and instead would be motivated.
What's the feeling like in the emergency room at the hospital you work at when you have professionals who are preparing for a possible surge of COVID-19 patients? And you see these stories across the country with medical professionals lacking enough access to protective equipment while they work. What's the feeling like in the emergency room you work at?
Well, I think El Paso has been a little bit lucky in that we haven't had our surge yet, like places in New York and Louisiana, and that has given us some time to really prepare. And so we have all had training on how to put on and remove our personal protective equipment. And we have, tents set up out front to help us triage patients appropriately. We're implementing some telehealth visits. So I think we really have been lucky in that way. And being able to prepare like this really has helped mitigate some of the fear that I think was possible.
This pandemic has taken the forefront and caused a lot of hospitals to basically shut down some of their elective services that they provide, or elective surgeries or day-to-day operations due to the COVID-19 outbreak. I know that there's some people that might not be able to get a physical now. Do you see this having an impact on other diseases in the area that people may be facing or may not even know that they have yet due to this pandemic?
That is definitely a concern. Regarding surgery, I know they've canceled elective surgeries, but they're still doing urgent and emergency surgeries for those people who need them. In terms of access to primary care, I know a lot of physician offices are starting to do telemedicine. So that at least is an option for many patients who might need medication refills or care for their chronic illnesses. But that certainly is a risk. We don't want people who have an emergency to stay home out of fear of getting the virus. So, try to stay home as much as you can to be safe and keep your loved ones healthy. But if you have a medical emergency, please come to the emergency room and we will take care of you.
Dr. Watkins, I want to thank you for your time and helpful information, and we wish you the best.
All right, thank you very much for having me.